Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. The hospital pediatrics wing is a place of pain and resilience, fear and healing. Normally, families are there for purely medical reasons, but for Thomas Hooven, the hospital became a space for a different kind of recovery. Jake Gyllenhaal stars in the new movie Stronger, and he reads Tom's essay, Nursing a Wound in an Appropriate Setting.
I started my pediatrics residency on the cardiology unit, which was appropriate. My heart had a giant hole in it. Just after I graduated from medical school, as I was moving into my fiancé's New York apartment, she ended our relationship. We went out to dinner that night, and after we came home, she told me we were through. She and I had been together 12 years, engaged for 2. We had a wedding planned for 3 weeks later. "I can't believe you're doing this," I said from the edge of her bed. "I know we'll always be best friends," she said. I left just after sunrise, suitcase in hand, feeling as if I had just fallen from a moving train. It seemed unimaginable that I was meant to report for duty at the hospital in less than a month. My new employers were expecting a freshly minted physician, full of knowledge and an eagerness to heal. As it was, I could barely remember my name. I took a cab to the airport, booked a flight to my father's house in Minnesota, and stayed there until it was time to limp back to New York to start my residency. I spent the hour that was supposed to have been our wedding ceremony sitting in the crook of a tree, staring at the suburban horizon. The evening was silent. The weather was perfect. After returning from Minnesota, I moved to a marginal block in a neighborhood of highway access ramps and overpasses. Plastic bags blew along the empty streets. Brief walks to and from the hospital and solitary meals with dust motes swirling in my sparse living room were all that interrupted the otherwise constant blur of rounding on patients in the dim morning hours, writing hundreds of medical orders, and updating parents, who ranged from frantic to silently resigned. There are rules about the number of hours a training physician can work in a hospital, but the limit remains high. 80 hours a week. When done back-to-back and filled with children suffering from complex illnesses, weeks like that tend to metastasize, leaving room for nothing else. When I started my work as a doctor, it took every bit of concentration to put aside my private sadness and focus on my patients. I was lost, and it's a wonder I didn't hurt anyone. In moments of downtime, and especially in the depths of night when the unit was quiet, memories of my ex and my longing for her would overtake me. Like a persistent virus, loneliness lived inside me. My ex and I had gone to the same high school. As two children of divorce who had been caught between battling parents, we were drawn to each other like compatriots. We held on to our young romance through 4 years at separate colleges and journeyed across the country to attend graduate school together. We seemed on the cusp of the grown-up lives we had imagined. Actually, we were about to disintegrate. As a couple, we did not fight. Our relationship was conceived from a need for security and stayed small, quiet, and safe. We came together in the disorienting haze of parental conflict, and from the start, we shared a tacit assumption that fighting meant losing love. At the end, surrounded by cardboard boxes we had spent the day hauling into her living room, I asked over and over why she was leaving me. She couldn't articulate a single reason. "I don't know," she said. After more than a decade together, that non-answer amazed me. It seemed the most brutal response possible. But now, more than 5 years later, her response seems less surprising and more diagnostic of why we failed. Our relationship had never developed the vocabulary necessary to express the many colors and intricacies of adult emotion. We had no language for negativity. She must have sensed that and realized we were headed for serious trouble. Compared with many of my patients that year, whose illnesses, complications, and treatment regimens would fill a textbook, my burden of heartache was light. Still, my patients and I inhabited a space in the city together at a time when we were suffering. The hospital is a place for that. Simultaneous suffering. I remember a 15-year-old boy with severe renal failure, tubes through his flanks draining urine directly from his ravaged kidneys. His mother rarely visited him over the many months that he spent admitted. Every night, he would mount dramatic protests about the frequent injections his disease required. One time, his howling screams summoned me to the hallway. It was after midnight. Crouched and sobbing against the wall, head buried in his palms, he looked barely older than 7. I sat on the floor next to him and put my hand on his shoulder. We stayed there for about 15 minutes, me in my scrubs, him in his thin yellow gown with clowns on it, both isolated amid the nurses, medications, and monitors. After that, he returned to his room, took the shots, and went to bed. I went back to the tiny sleeping quarters for overnight staff and traipsed into the past, scrolling through old emails from my vanished fiancé and waiting for dawn. Healing comes slowly, but it comes. A budding pediatrician must observe lives cut inexplicably short. The 14-year-old girl with cardiomyopathy who had a heart attack before my eyes and died staring at the ceiling. But I've also been privileged to witness how most gravely ill children overcome or bypass their challenges. They mature. They become wryer. They pick up idiosyncrasies. They smile. Despite themselves. My patients and I also healed together. For me, healing started through a desire to be a better doctor, the drive to improve my skills as a physician, to recognize diagnoses, know disease mechanisms, and determine the correct treatments, buoyed me, and eventually pulled me out of my sorrow. The long days that were at first such a Sisyphean cycle became a new refuge, For a time, the study and practice of medicine was my only and perfect partner. Sometime during my second year of residency, I emerged from the elevator to see the boy with renal failure cruising down the hallway, using the wheeled base of his IV pole as a skateboard. He had a paper airplane in his hand and tossed it as he approached, laughing as it looped past my head. He was getting better, and so was I. My ex and I are not in touch. Our relationship, so long in the making and so quick to end, was like an ornamental piece of crystal. Aesthetically pleasing, but lacking resilience, and once shattered, irrecoverable. Looking back at the various romantic and not-so-romantic dating experiences I had afterwards, it's hard to separate my growth as an emotionally conversant partner from my development as a capable physician. Both happened simultaneously and gradually, through stretches of triumph and sorrow. There were no eureka moments, and neither ever really ended. The turmoil I experienced as an intern left me with a deeper understanding of how pain works, how it feels, how it ebbs, and how it leaves you less naive. I also learned to open up to important facets of life that my previous relationship had locked out: unhappiness, uncertainty, regret. Comfort around feelings like these is crucial in both medicine and intimate relationships. It's the basis of empathy. I didn't understand that before my ex left me, and I learned it the hard way. By the time I met my wife, I was a changed man and a real doctor, and our love developed differently from any I had ever experienced before. Less like a crystal vase, more like a basketball. Our relationship is made for bouncing, for good and sometimes rough play that modern professional lives generate. We do have fights, oh yes we do, but they do not threaten our foundation. They deepen it. I would not return to those difficult and lonely days any more than I imagine my young patients, now grown, would return to the wards where I labored to keep them alive and well. But I would not choose to have avoided that experience either. I ran into the kid with renal failure on the street a while back. He was with a bunch of his pals. It had been years since he left the hospital, and frankly, I wouldn't have recognized him. He had filled out. His chronically ill little boy's face had developed into a sly, winking young man's. His skin had darkened from sun. He was dressed in a denim jacket with a Bob Marley shirt underneath. "Doc," he called out. "Hey, Doc." We stood there talking for a few minutes, enough for me to learn he was finishing high school and doing well. Somewhere nearby, an ambulance siren wailed. I watched him walk away to rejoin his friends, and then turned to enter the children's hospital.
Jake Gyllenhaal reading Tom Hooven's essay, Nursing a Wound in an Appropriate Setting. Coming up, Tom gives us an update on his career and his love life.
I came packaged with a lot of fears, believe me. But she accepted that and seemed to see me, and she does to this day.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Thomas Hooven is married now, and he has two children. He's finished his medical training and is now a neonatologist, a pediatrician who specializes in caring for infants. His work continues to teach him as much about love and relationships as about medicine and science.
My job lets me meet people and become involved with families at moments in their life that are scary and significant, probably beyond anything else that will ever happen to them. And it's a tremendous privilege for me to be involved at that time. And through helping families through times like this, I continually learn more about what it feels like to be in pain, how empathy helps that pain, and how it helps people get through really trying times.
And just before his essay was published in the New York Times, Tom reached out to his former fiancée.
I sent her an email saying I had written this and that I had tried to be fair to her. I hoped she saw it that way. She wrote back a really warm email and said congratulations. She said that she always thought I was an excellent writer. And then, of course, the essay came out and I wondered how it landed with her, but I never heard. She never sent me anything, which I consider absolutely her prerogative. I imagine that for her, it's hard to contact me in the same way that for a long time it was hard and painful to contact her. So I don't blame her for that.
So Tom learned a lot of lessons from his experience.
I hope that people reading it will take from it, if they're in that situation, that you'll emerge and you'll actually emerge a better partner and a healthier partner than you would have otherwise been. I really believe that.
He knows that because he can see it in his relationship with his wife.
I think I sensed in her the same understanding around the need to communicate openly. She's a great communicator in every respect. And as our relationship built, it happened differently than had happened before. It was much more intentional and based on talking everything through, all of the feelings that we had and all of the fears that we had. And I came packaged with a lot of fears, believe me. But she accepted that and seemed to see me, and she does to this day.
Tom Hooven lives in New York City with his family. He still works at Columbia University Medical Center, the same hospital where he did his residency. Coming up, some thoughts from Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times, and more from Jake Gyllenhaal.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Dan Jones says that he was struck by how Thomas Hooven's idea of love changed after his relationship with his ex ended.
Love for them was escaping conflict. And he articulates that that didn't allow their relationship to have conflict. And it was just such a sort of smart articulation of, you know, what love requires and that love is a more rough and tumble thing and how he learns that by being in this hospital setting. And what a moving journey that was to sort of come out the other end of this just brutal experience with not only a greater understanding of what love is, but being able to describe what that understanding is to other people, almost like the doctor as teacher in this case.
Jake Gyllenhaal says that he found Tom Hooven's essay deeply moving.
Someone said to me recently to treat everyone that you meet as if they've had a broken heart. And I feel like I don't always live that way. And if I did, I think I would live a much richer and fuller and happier life, and that's where I want to get to. So I think this story just shows us that the only way to being the human that we wish to be is inevitably through some pain.
Jake Gyllenhaal. He stars in the new movie, Stronger. Next week, Anne Dowd reads the story of a woman watching the man she married go through a gender transition.
It wasn't until we were married that my husband, finally feeling loved, admitted to himself that he was transsexual, that he was, inside, a woman, that he did not want to be the man I married.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, Amory Sievertson, and Caitlin O'Keefe. Extra help this week from producer Catherine Brewer. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.